keeping our minds in such thoughts, we'll naturally feel affection for others, and our motivation to help them will be based on genuinely wanting them to be happy. Codependence doesn't arise from one person in a relationship being manipulative, dependent, or demanding. It evolves when two or more people's attachment, anger, and fear mutually feed into each other's in unhealthy ways. If one person has cultivated non-attachment and acts with genuine love and compassion, even if the other consciously or unconsciously tries to manipulate him or her, the person with a clear motivation won't get hooked into a pattern of unhealthy interactions. Chapter 4. Meditation. What is meditation? Nowadays, meditation is sometimes confused with other activities. Meditation is not simply relaxing the body and mind. Nor is it imagining being a successful person with wonderful possessions, good relationships, appreciation from others, and fame. This is merely daydreaming about objects of attachment. Meditation is not sitting in the full Vajra position, with an arrow straight back and a holy expression on our face. Meditation is a mental activity. Even if the body is in perfect position, if our mind is running wild thinking about objects of attachment or anger, we're not meditating. Meditation is also not a concentrated state, such as we may have when painting, reading, or doing any activity that interests us. Nor is it simply being aware of what we are doing at any particular moment. The Tibetan word for meditation is gom. This has the same verbal root as to habituate or to familiarize. Meditation means habituating ourselves to constructive, realistic, and beneficial emotions and attitudes. It builds up good habits of the mind. Meditation is used to transform our thoughts and views so that they are more compassionate and correspond to reality. How do we learn to meditate? What kinds of meditation are there? These days, many people teach meditation and spiritual paths. But we should examine them well and not just excitedly jump into something. Some people think that they can invent their own way to meditate and don't need to learn from a skilled teacher. This is very unwise. If we wish to meditate, we must first receive instruction from a qualified teacher. Listening to teachings given by a reliable source like the Buddha is to our advantage, because these teachings have been studied by scholars and practiced by skilled meditators who have attained results throughout the centuries. In this way, we can establish that the lineage of teachings and meditation practice is valid and worthy of being practiced. Such a practice was not merely concocted according to someone's whim. First, we listen to teachings and deepen our understanding by thinking about them. Then, through meditation, we integrate what we have learned with our mind. For example, we hear teachings on how to develop impartial love for all beings. Next, we check up and investigate whether that is possible. We come to understand each step in the practice. Then we build up this good habit of the mind by integrating it with our being and training ourselves in the various steps leading to the experience of impartial love. That is meditation. Meditation is of two general types, stabilizing and analytical. The former is designed to develop concentration, and the latter to develop understanding and insight. Within these two broad categories, the Buddha taught a wide variety of meditation techniques, and the lineages of these are extant today. An example of stabilizing meditation is focusing our mind on our breath and observing all the sensations that occur as we breathe. This calms our mind and frees it from its usual chatter, enabling us to be more peaceful in our daily life and not to worry so much. The visualized image of the Buddha may also be used as the object upon which we stabilize our mind and develop concentration. While some non-Buddhist traditions suggest looking at a flower or candle to develop concentration, this is generally not recommended by Buddhist traditions because meditation is an activity of our mental consciousness, not our sense consciousness. Other meditations help us to control anger, attachment, and jealousy by developing positive and realistic attitudes toward other people. These are instances of analytical or checking meditation. Other examples are reflecting on our precious human life, impermanence, and the emptiness of inherent existence. Here we practice thinking in constructive ways in order to gain proper understanding and eventually go beyond conceptual thought. Purification meditations cleanse the imprints of negative actions and stop nagging feelings of guilt. Meditating on a cone, a perplexing puzzle designed to break our usual fixed conceptions, is done in some Zen, Chan, traditions. Some meditations involve visualization and mantra recitation. These are a few of the many types of meditation taught in Buddhism. What are the benefits of meditation? By building up good habits of the mind in meditation, our behavior in daily life gradually changes. Our anger decreases, we are better able to make decisions, and we become less dissatisfied and restless. These results of meditation can be experienced now. But we should always try to have a broader and more encompassing motivation to meditate than just our own present happiness. If we generate the motivation to meditate in order to make preparation for future lives, to attain liberation from the cycle of constantly recurring problems, or to reach the state of full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, then naturally our minds will also be peaceful now. In addition, we'll be able to attain those high and noble goals. Having a regular meditation practice, even if it's only for a short time each day, is extremely beneficial. Some people think, "My day is so busy with career, family, and social obligations that I cannot meditate. I'll leave it until I'm older and my life is less busy. Daily meditation is the job of monks and nuns." This is incorrect. If meditation is helpful to us, we should make time for it every day. Even if we don't want to meditate, having some quiet time for ourselves each day is important. We need time to sit peacefully and reflect upon what we do and why, to read a Dharma book, or to do some chanting. To be happy, we must learn to like our own company and to be content alone. Setting aside some quiet time, preferably in the morning before the start of the day's activities, is necessary, especially in modern societies where people are so busy. We always have time to nourish our bodies. We seldom skip meals because we see they are important. Likewise, we should reserve time to nourish our mind and heart, because they too are important for our sense of well-being. After all, it is our mind, not our body, that continues on to future lives, carrying with it the karmic imprints of our actions. Dharma practice is not done for the Buddha's benefit, but for our own. The Dharma describes how to create the causes for happiness. And since we all want happiness, we should practice the Dharma as much as we can. Some Buddhist traditions use visualization and mantra recitation during meditation, while others discourage these. Why? The Buddha taught a variety of techniques because different people have different inclinations. Each technique may approach a similar goal, but from a different vantage point. For example, when doing breathing meditation, emphasis is placed on developing concentration on the breath itself. In this case, visualizing something would distract us from the object of meditation, which is the breath. However, another meditation technique uses the visualized image of the Buddha as its object of meditation. A purification meditation could involve, for example, visualization of the Buddha with light radiating from the Buddha into us and all the beings who we imagine seated around us. This meditation takes the natural tendency of our mind to imagine things and transforms it into the path to enlightenment. Instead of imagining a holiday with our boyfriend or girlfriend, which just incites our attachment, we imagine the serene figure of the Buddha, which inspires a balanced and peaceful state of mind. Similarly, reciting mantras takes the natural tendency of our mind to chatter and transforms it into the path. Rather than continuing our internal dialogue about what we like and what we don't, we use that inner voice to recite mantras. Mantra recitation helps us to develop concentration and can have a purifying effect on the mind. Is it better to do just one type of meditation or a variety? This depends on the specific Buddhist tradition we follow and on the instructions of our spiritual teacher. Those in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition train in several different types of meditation because many different aspects of our character need to be cultivated. Thus, we may do breathing meditation to calm the mind, loving-kindness meditation to generate compassion and altruism for others, visualization of the Buddha or a deity along with mantra recitation to purify negative karmic imprints, and analytical meditation combined with concentration to develop the wisdom realizing emptiness. When we have developed a general overall view of the gradual path to enlightenment, we'll understand the purpose of each meditation and where it fits in along the path. Then we can gradually develop many different abilities and sides of our character. Can one develop clairvoyant powers through practicing Buddhism? Is this a worthwhile goal to pursue? Yes, one can. But that isn't the principal goal of Dharma practice. Some people get very excited about the prospect of having clairvoyance.
Wait until I tell my friends about this. Everyone will think I'm special and will come to ask me for advice.
What an egotistical motivation for wanting to be clairvoyant. If we still get angry and are unable to control what we say, think, and do, what use is running after clairvoyance? Desiring clairvoyant powers because we want to be famous and well-respected is not only a distraction to our practice, but antithetical to it. Becoming a kind and altruistic person benefits both ourselves and others much more. Once a child asked me if I had clairvoyance. Could I bend a spoon through concentration? Could I stop a clock or walk through a wall? I told him no, and even if I could, what use would it be? Would that lessen the suffering in the world? In fact, the person whose spoon I ruined may suffer more. The point of our human existence isn't to build up our egos, but to develop a kind heart and a sense of universal responsibility working for world peace. Loving kindness is the real miracle. If one has a kind heart, then developing clairvoyant powers could be beneficial for others. However, sincere practitioners do not go around advertising their clairvoyance. In fact, most of them will deny they have such abilities and will be very humble. The Buddha warned against public displays of clairvoyance unless they were necessary to benefit others. Humble people are actually more impressive than boastful ones. Their serenity and respect for others shine through, and this gladdens our heart. People who have subdued pride, have loving kindness toward others, and are developing their wisdom are people we can trust. Such people are working for the benefit of others, not for their own prestige and wealth. Can meditation be dangerous? Some people say you can go crazy from it. Is that true? If we learn to meditate from an experienced teacher who instructs us in a reliable method, and if we follow these instructions correctly, there is no danger at all. Meditation is simply building up good habits of the mind. We do this in a gradual fashion. Thus, doing advanced practices without proper instruction is unwise. If we build up our capabilities gradually, we will be able to progress to more advanced practices without difficulty, and one day we'll become a Buddha. Chapter 5. Impermanence and Suffering. Buddhism talks a lot about impermanence, death, and suffering. Isn't such an approach to life unhealthy and pessimistic? The word suffering is not an accurate translation of the Pali or Sanskrit word dukkha. Dukkha has the connotation of unsatisfactory experiences. It means that everything isn't completely wonderful in our lives. While most of us don't feel we are suffering all the time, we would agree that not everything in our lives is perfect. Even when we're relatively happy, there's no guarantee that things will continue to go well. One small event can change our entire experience. This is what is meant by unsatisfactory experiences, dukkha, or suffering. The Buddha merely described our present situation. Therefore, he was being realistic, not pessimistic. His motivation for describing this was to help us seek the means to free ourselves from it. The purpose of contemplating impermanence, death, and unsatisfactory experiences isn't to become depressed and have the joy taken out of life. Rather, the purpose is to rid ourselves of attachment and false expectations.
If we become emotionally afraid or depressed when thinking about these things, then we are not contemplating them correctly. Meditating on these subjects should make our minds calm and lucid because it decreases our clinging attachment and the confusion that attachment causes in our lives. At present, our minds are easily overwhelmed by the false projections of attachment. We see people and objects in an unrealistic way. Things are changing moment by moment, but they appear to us to be constant and unchanging. That is why we are upset when they break. We may say all these things are impermanent, but our words aren't consistent with our innate view, which mistakenly considers our body and our loved ones to be unchanging. This unrealistic conception causes us pain because we have expectations of things and people that cannot be fulfilled. Our loved ones cannot live forever. A relationship doesn't remain the same. The new car will not always be the shiny model just off the showroom floor. Thus, we are perpetually disappointed when we must part with the people we care for, when our possessions break, when our body becomes weak or old. If we had a more realistic view of these things and accepted their impermanence, not just with our words but with our heart, then such disappointment would not come. Contemplating impermanence and death also eliminates many of the useless worries that prevent us from being happy and relaxed. Ordinarily, we become upset when we are criticized or insulted. We are angry when our possessions are stolen and feel jealous if someone else gets the promotion we wanted. We are proud of our looks or athletic ability. All of these attitudes are disturbing emotions that leave harmful imprints on our mind stream and bring us problems in our future lives as well as in this life. However, if we contemplate the transient nature of these things, we accept that our life will end and that none of these things can accompany us at death. Understanding that, we will stop exaggerating their importance, and they will no longer be so problematic for us. That doesn't mean that we become apathetic towards the people and environment around us. On the contrary, by eliminating the wrong conception of permanence and the disturbing attitudes that stem from it, our minds will become clearer and will be able to enjoy things for what they are. We'll live more in the present, appreciating things as they are now, without fantasies about what they should be or might become. We'll worry less about small matters and will be less distracted when we meditate. We will not be so touchy about how others treat us. By reflecting on impermanent and unsatisfactory experiences, we can deal better with all the unpleasant events that occur because we are still in the cycle of constantly recurring problems. In short, by correctly contemplating these truths, our mental state will become healthier. Thus, the understanding of our mortality inspires us to think deeply about what is important in life and to set clear priorities. If we do so, our life will be more vibrant, and when the time of death arrives, we will have no regrets. For example, no one dies thinking, "I should have worked more overtime." But people do die regretting that they mistreated others or did not tell those they loved that they loved them. People die regretting that they did minimal spiritual practice. By reflecting on death in advance, we will do what is important while we are alive and will avoid such regrets at the time of death. Why is there suffering? How can we stop it? Unsatisfactory experiences occur simply because the causes for them exist. One cause is our disturbing attitudes, such as ignorance, attachment, and anger. The other is the harmful actions we have engaged in, such as killing, stealing, and lying, which are motivated by disturbing attitudes. By developing the wisdom realizing selflessness, we will eliminate the disturbing attitudes and the contaminated actions they cause, thus stopping the source of our problems. As a result, the painful consequences will not follow, and instead will abide in nirvana, a state of lasting happiness. In the meantime, before we generate this wisdom, by doing purification practices, we will impede the ripening of the results of our previous destructive actions. The Buddha also taught many techniques for mentally transforming difficult circumstances into the path to enlightenment. We can learn about these and practice them when we have problems. Do we have to suffer to attain liberation, nirvana? Must we renounce the world to become a Buddha?
Practicing Buddha's teachings brings happiness, not pain. The spiritual path itself isn't painful, and there is no special virtue in suffering. We already have enough problems, so there's no sense in causing ourselves more in the name of practicing religion. However, that doesn't mean that we won't have any problems while practicing the Dharma. While we're on the path, previous destructive actions that haven't yet been purified may ripen and bring problems. When this happens, we can transform the situation into the path to enlightenment by using the various techniques the Buddha taught. Sometimes our anger, attachment, or jealousy may arise strongly and be very disquieting when we're trying to practice. This happens because our disturbing attitudes haven't yet been eliminated. After all, we don't become Buddhas after practicing the Dharma for just a short time. We can apply the Buddha's teachings to subdue these unpleasant emotions while being patient with ourselves and recognizing that purifying our minds takes time. Although the English word renunciation is often used in Buddhist translations, it doesn't convey the precise meaning. It is more accurate to say that we must develop the determination to be free from cyclic existence and to attain liberation. We don't need to renounce people and things. Rather, we need to give up our clinging attachment to them. There is nothing inherently wrong with the world. The real problem lies in our disturbing attitudes. For example, money isn't the problem. It is merely sheets of paper. However, our clinging to and craving for money cause big problems. These erroneous and harmful attitudes are to be given up. Of course, if we are very attached to something, it's a good idea to distance ourselves from it for a while to calm our clinging. If we're attached to ice cream, it's better not to go to an ice cream parlor. Later, when we've developed a more balanced and altruistic motivation, we can actually use the objects of our previous attachment to benefit others. Buddhism talks about accepting our suffering and also about freeing ourselves from suffering. Are these contradictory? No. Accepting our difficulties doesn't mean becoming apathetic and resigned to suffering. Rather, our experience at a particular moment, whatever it is the reality of that moment. When we refuse to accept this, we find ourselves in conflict with reality. On the other hand, we can accept our present unhappiness and still work to free ourselves from future unsatisfactory experiences. For example, if we accept the transient nature of our world, we will cease trying to control things that, by their nature, are out of our control. We will be at peace with whatever life presents, and simultaneously work to benefit others with an altruistic aspiration that appreciates every being's potential to transcend suffering and become enlightened. Chapter 6. Selflessness. Do selflessness and emptiness have the same meaning? What is the advantage of realizing selflessness or emptiness? In general, these two terms are synonymous, although when studying philosophy in depth, there are differences between them. By realizing emptiness, we will be able to cleanse our minds of all defilements and obscurations. At the moment, our minds are obscured by ignorance. The way we perceive ourselves and other phenomena as existing is not the way that they really exist. It's similar to people who wear sunglasses all the time. Everything they see appears dark, and they think that is the way things are. In fact, if they took their sunglasses off, they would find that things actually exist in a different way. Another analogy for the view of ignorance is an audience who watches a movie and thinks that the people on the screen are real. The viewers become very emotional and involved in the fate of the characters. Being attached to the hero, they are antagonistic towards the characters who threaten him. The audience may even cry out, cringe, or jump up in their seat when the hero is harmed. In fact, these reactions are out of proportion, for there are no real people on the screen at all. They are only projections, which are dependent on causes and conditions, such as the film projector, and the screen. Realizing emptiness is analogous to understanding that the movie is empty of real people. However, the appearance of the characters does exist, dependent on the film, actors, screen, and so forth. If we understand this, we can still enjoy the film,
but no longer go up and down emotionally as the hero experiences various events. By generating the wisdom that directly realizes emptiness, we will perceive the mode in which we and other phenomena exist. They are empty of our fantasized projections on them, most importantly, the projection of inherent existence. Having this wisdom realizing reality will gradually free ourselves from the bonds of the ignorance that misconceives reality. Familiarizing our minds with emptiness will gradually eliminate all ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, jealousy, and other disturbing attitudes and negative emotions from our mind stream. By doing so, we'll cease to engage in the destructive actions motivated by them. Freed from the influence of ignorance, negative emotions, and the actions motivated by them, we'll be liberated from the causes of our problems, and thus the problems also will cease. In other words, the wisdom realizing emptiness is the true path to happiness. What does it mean to say all persons and phenomena are empty of true or inherent existence? This means that persons, like you and me, and all other phenomena, tables, etc., are empty of these fantasized qualities that we project onto them. One of the principal deceptive qualities that we project onto persons and phenomena is that they are inherently existent. That is, that they exist without depending on causes and conditions, parts, and the consciousness which conceives them and gives them a name. Thus, in our ordinary view, things appear to have some true or inherent nature, as if they were really there, as if we could find these real, independent entities if we searched for them. They appear to be there, independent of the causes and conditions that created them, independent of the parts of which they are made, and independent of the mind which conceives and labels them. This is the appearance of true or inherent existence, and our minds grasp it as real. However, when we examine things analytically to discover if things exist in the independent way they superficially appear to, we find that they do not. They are empty of these fantasized projections. Still, they do exist, but they exist dependently, for they rely on causes and conditions, on the parts which compose them, and on the mind which conceives them and gives them a name. If all people and phenomena are selfless or empty, does that mean that nothing exists? No, phenomena and people still exist. After all, I am still here typing and you are still reading. Emptiness is not the same as nihilism. Rather, people and phenomena are empty of our fantasized projections upon them. They lack what our wrong conceptions attribute to them. They do not exist in the way they appear to us at present, but they do exist. That is, they don't exist independently, but they do dependently exist. For example, someone wearing sunglasses sees dark trees. There are no independent dark trees, but we cannot say there are no trees at all. The trees exist. They just do not exist in the way they appear to the person with sunglasses. Is realizing emptiness the same as having a blank mind, free from all thoughts? No. When emptiness is directly realized, the mind is free from thoughts and concepts. However, just removing all thoughts from our mind, peaceful though it may be, is not the realization of emptiness. After all, cows' minds are pretty blank, they do not have many conceptual thoughts, but they haven't realized emptiness. Realizing emptiness involves first understanding what things are empty of, inherent existence, and then realizing that inherent existence is a hallucination that has never existed at all. Sometimes people feel that their lives are empty. Is this the same emptiness spoken of by the Buddha? No. In everyday language, we say people feel empty when they lack goals or close relationships with others or lack a sense of meaning in their lives. This is a lack of external relationships, clear personal goals, or internal tranquility. It is resolved by developing self-confidence, setting priorities in life, and letting go of unrealistic expectations. The emptiness that the Buddha spoke of, on the other hand, concerns the mode of existence of phenomena. It is the absence of inherent existence. That is, things do not exist under their own power, from their own side, independent of all other things.
Understanding this emptiness leads to a feeling of fullness and meaning in our lives, because we will be free from all restricting misconceptions and disturbing emotions. This emptiness is realized through studying, thinking about, and meditating on the Buddha's teachings. Psychologists tell us that a strong sense of self is essential to be psychologically healthy, but it seems Buddhism says there is no self. How can we reconcile these two views? When psychologists speak of a sense of self, they are referring to the feeling that oneself is an efficacious person, someone who is self-confident and can act in the world. Buddhists agree that such a sense of self is both realistic and necessary. However, the sense of self that Buddhism says is unrealistic is that of a very solid, unchanging, independent I. Such a self never has and never will exist. To understand this is to realize emptiness. Strange though it may sound, someone may have a psychologically weak sense of self that in Buddhist parlance would be considered strong self-grasping. For example, a person with poor self-esteem may focus a lot on himself and have a strong feeling of the existence of an independent self that is inferior, unlovable, and a failure. From a Buddhist viewpoint, such an independent self does not exist, although a conventional self does. What is the best way to realize the emptiness of inherent existence? This realization is difficult to gain and is attained at advanced stages of the path, so we must develop our understanding slowly. The path to liberation and enlightenment is a gradual one that is practiced in steps. First, we train in the elementary aspects of the path, such as impermanence, refuge, the determination to be free from cyclic existence, love, and compassion. Then we listen to teachings on emptiness from knowledgeable and compassionate spiritual masters. As we think about and discuss these teachings, our understanding will become clearer. Once we have a clear idea of the subject, we can begin to integrate it into our mind through meditation. One meditation on emptiness of the person is called the four-point analysis. The first point is to identify the negated object, that is, the inherently existent thing that does not exist. To do this, we recall a time when we had a strong negative emotion. For example, when someone unfairly accused us and there was a strong sense of an independent I. The second point is to determine that if such an independent I existed, it would have to be either totally the same as either the body or mind, or completely unrelated to the body and mind. Then, keeping one part of our attention focused on the sense of that independent I, we investigate to discover if we can find it. We examine our body to see if any part of our body is ourself. We examine our mind to see if any mental state or consciousness is ourself. That is the third point. In the fourth point, we investigate if the self is somewhere else, totally separate from the body and mind. Determining that such an independent self cannot be found anywhere, we then conclude that it does not exist at all. That absence of an inherently existent self is the emptiness of the person. We then focus on that single-pointedly. In doing the meditation on emptiness, we must be careful not to fall to the extreme of nihilism, thinking that no self at all exists. While an independent self does not exist, a conventional, dependent one does. Chapter 7. Science, Creation, and Rebirth. What is the relationship between Buddhism and science? They have many points in common. For example, both depend on logic and investigation to ascertain the nature of phenomena. Both discourage blind faith and encourage free inquiry on the part of the student. Buddhism does not contradict current scientific theories about the origin of this universe or the physical evolution of the human species. In fact, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said that if scientific findings contradict what is written in Buddhist scriptures, then Buddhists must accept that new information. However, if science cannot actively disprove what is stated in the scriptures, there is no need to abandon that concept. For example, although scientists have not yet proven the existence of rebirth,
they have not been able to disprove it. Both science and Buddhism use the theory of cause and effect to explain how things function. Science investigates cause and effect as it functions in the physical, material world, whereas Buddhism explores it in terms of the mind. Both emphasize the dependent nature of phenomena. Things rely on causes, the parts of which they are composed, and the consciousness that observes and labels them. Quantum physicists are becoming increasingly aware of the latter when doing experiments. They recognize that the experimenter is not an independent entity who objectively observes external phenomena. Rather, he or she influences the results of an experiment simply by observing it. This relates to the Buddha's teaching on the emptiness of inherent existence, which emphasizes the dependent relationship between consciousness and the objects it perceives. Many scientists believe it is impossible to find the smallest partless particles from which all matter is created. Buddhism agrees that isolating these smallest independent particles is impossible. Yet at meetings with scientists, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has mentioned a dependently existing space particle which contains the potentials of all other elements in the universe. What precisely is meant by space particle, and how it relates to scientific theories and discoveries, needs to be explored further. The Buddhist concept of dependent arising can also be applied in the area of neurology, where perception is seen not as an isolated phenomenon, but as the coming together of various factors. Just as scientists say it is impossible to set apart one particular cell or chemical electrical process that constitutes perception, so Buddhists say that cognition is dependent on a variety of factors, none of which constitutes perception in and of itself. More scientists are becoming interested in Buddhism, and some Buddhist scholars are learning about modern science. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has attended several conferences with scientists that have been fruitful for everyone concerned. In addition, he encourages monks and nuns to learn about science and to incorporate scientific views into the debates they hold. How was the world created? Everything that is created arises from the causes that produce it. Something cannot be created out of nothing. The physical world of forms that we see around us was produced by previous moments of form. This is the field investigated by scientists. At present, many scientists agree on the Big Bang theory, in which all forms of our universe were once tightly condensed. But even the matter that existed before the Big Bang had causes. It was a continuation of subtler physical elements that, in turn, were a continuation from universes that existed before ours. In this way, the continuity of form is traced back infinitely. What is the mind? Our mind is all of our emotional and cognitive experiences. It includes not only the consciousnesses that perceive sense objects, colors and shapes, sounds, odors, tastes, and tactile objects, but also the mental consciousness, which thinks and which has the capacity to directly perceive more subtle objects, such as emptiness. The word mind in a Buddhist sense also includes what in English is referred to as heart, as in, he has a kind heart. To emphasize the continuity of consciousness, we also use the word mind stream to refer to our mind. Each person has a separate mind, or mind stream. The mind is formless, while the brain is part of the body. Our body and our mind are separate entities. While the mind is immaterial, the body is material, composed of atoms. What is the relationship between the brain and the mind? The brain is a physical organ and is atomic in nature. The mind is formless and is characterized by clarity and awareness. While we're alive, our brain and mind influence each other. The brain provides the physical support for our sense consciousnesses and gross mental consciousness. If the brain and central nervous system are damaged, the functioning of the mind is affected. Similarly, our mental state, be it peaceful or agitated, affects our physical health and our nervous system. There are subtler levels of mind that, according to Buddhism, do not rely on the physical body as a support. The subtlest mind, which continues on to the next life, is an example.
Thus, skilled practitioners can meditate with their subtlest consciousness, even after they are brain dead. Kyabje Ling Rinpoche, His Holiness the Dalai Lama's senior tutor, did this for 13 days after his breath ceased. Scientists are very interested in studying this, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama has given his approval for them to measure great practitioners' brain functions at death and afterward. The problem is that scheduling this is difficult, because the scientists must be ready with their equipment in India when a great practitioner dies. What is rebirth? Rebirth refers to a person's mind taking one body after another under the power of ignorance and contaminated actions. While we are alive, our body and mind are linked, but at death they separate. Each has its own continuum. The body becomes a corpse, and the mind continues on to take another body. This process of rebirth under the control of ignorance and contaminated actions is cyclic existence, the cycle of constantly recurring problems that we experience. In cyclic existence, sentient beings take rebirth in any of six types of life forms. Some of these life forms, hellish ones, hungry ghosts, and animals, experience more suffering than happiness. Other life forms, humans, demigods, and gods, are considered relatively happy births. Beings repeatedly take rebirth in all of these life forms until they free themselves from ignorance and attain liberation. How did our mind begin? Who or what created it? Each moment of mind is a continuation of the previous moment. Who we are and what we think and feel depends on who we were yesterday. Our present mind is a continuation of yesterday's mind. That is why we can remember what happened to us in the past. One moment of our mind was caused by the previous moment of mind. This continuity can be traced back to childhood and to being a fetus in our mother's womb. Even before the time of conception, our mind stream existed. Its previous moments were linked to another body. Our mind has no beginning, and its continuity is infinite. This may be difficult to grasp initially, but if we use the example of a number line, it becomes easier. From the zero position, looking left, there is no first negative number, and looking right, there is no last highest number. One more can always be added. In the same way, our mind stream has no beginning and no end. We all have had an infinite number of past rebirths, and our mind will continue to exist infinitely. In fact, it would be impossible for our mind stream to have a beginning, because each moment of mind is caused by its previous moment. If a beginning existed, then either the first moment of mind had no cause, or it was caused by something other than a previous moment of mind. Both of those alternatives are impossible, for mind can only be produced by a previous moment of mind in its own continuum. By purifying our mind stream, we can make our future existence better than our present one. What connects one life with the next? Is there a soul, Atman, self, or real personality that goes from one life to another? Our mind has gross and subtle levels. The sense consciousnesses that see, hear, smell, taste, and feel tactile sensations, and the gross mental consciousness, which is busy thinking this and that, actively function while we are alive. At the time of death, they cease to function and absorb into the subtle, and finally the extremely subtle, mental consciousness. This extremely subtle mind bears the imprints of our actions, karma. After death, the continuity of the subtle mind, which is neither static nor an independent entity, leaves one body, enters the intermediate state, and then takes rebirth in another body. After the subtle mind joins with another body at the moment of conception, the gross sense consciousnesses and the gross mental consciousness reappear, and the person again sees, hears, thinks, and so forth. This extremely subtle mind, which goes from one life to the next, is a constantly changing, dependent phenomenon. For this reason, it is not considered to be a soul, Atman, self, or real personality. Thus, the Buddha taught the doctrine of selflessness, that there is no solid, independent, findable thing that can be isolated as the person. Do plants have minds?
Are they sentient beings? Could a computer ever become a sentient being? In general, according to Tibetan Buddhism, plants are not sentient beings. They are biologically alive, but that doesn't mean they are conscious. Plants may react to music or to people talking to them, just as iron filings react to a magnet placed near them. But that doesn't indicate that they have minds. However, in some rare cases, due to one's past actions, a person's mind may be attracted to a tree, for example, as its habitat. When asked whether computers could ever have consciousness, His Holiness the Dalai Lama responded that if at some point computers had the ability to act as a physical support for consciousness, and if a person had created the karma to be reborn inside one, then a computer could become a sentient being. Is there one universal mind that we are all a part of? According to Buddhism, no. Each of us has our own mind stream. However, when we purify our minds and become Buddhas, we will no longer have the feeling of being separate, isolated individuals. We will each be an individual Buddha, but we will have the same spiritual realizations. We won't feel cut off from each other. Where did ignorance come from? Were we once enlightened and then became separated from that state? No. Once someone is enlightened, there is no cause to again become confused and ignorant. If the cause for imperfection exists in the mind, the person is still ignorant. Thus, from a Buddhist viewpoint, we weren't once enlightened and then fell from that state. Such an occurrence is impossible because there's no cause for it to happen. Although all sentient beings have Buddha nature or Buddha potential, their minds have been clouded over by ignorance since beginningless time. Each moment of ignorance was produced from the preceding moment, without beginning. No external being created it. However, although ignorance has no beginning, it does have an end. It can be removed through the wisdom realizing emptiness, the lack of fantasized ways of existing. Once we perceive reality, our minds can no longer ignorantly misconceive things. What is Buddha nature? Buddha nature, or Buddha potential, is the potential that all sentient